This is Jeff Blankford, welcoming you to the September 24th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. One commonly held definition of insanity, mistakenly attributed to Albert Einstein, is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. That may be the most positive thing one can say about the policies and actions of President Obama as he launches an open-ended war on the Islamic State of the Levant, ISIL or ISIS, or now characterizes itself the Islamic State. After having the U.S. Air Force carry out more than 200 raids over areas of Iraq held by ISIL over the past month, with little to show for it, Obama on Monday, without waiting for a U.N. mandate, carried the air war across the border into those parts of Syria also controlled by ISIL and added to the mix Tomahawk cruise missiles launched from U.S. ships off the coast of Syria. To pretend this was not a unilateral U.S. action, he tells us that Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, and Jordan participated in the attack, although he didn't explain exactly how. No mention, to be sure, is made of the fact that without the active support of Saudi Arabia and Qatar, which have spearheaded the drive to overthrow Syrian President Bashar al-Assad since 2011, there would have been no ISIL or jihadist threat as we have come to know it. We have also been told that President Assad was advised of the mission, which openly violated Syrian sovereignty, but that he was not asked in advance for permission. What was ominous about the president's statement on the White House lawn yesterday was that he did not repeat a promise made in an earlier statement that there would be no American boots on the ground. Since he made that commitment to the American people, General Martin Dempsey, chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, told Congress that an air war against ISIL would not be enough, and it's likely he'll have to recommend to the president that U.S. armed forces will be needed to finish the job. The issue is further complicated by Obama's appointment of retired General John Allen to be in charge of getting U.S. allies to contribute troops, money, and arms to join the war on ISIL. Allen, much admired by Washington's neocons, has been calling for a robust U.S. war against ISIL since June. This morning, President Obama was in New York addressing the U.N. General Assembly, where he committed the U.S. to, quote, work with a broad coalition to dismantle this network of death, unquote. He will also be chairing a special meeting of the Security Council in which he is expected to introduce and push a resolution that will sanctify, after the fact, his decision to take the war on ISIL across the Iraqi border into Syria. He will also reportedly ask for a Security Council resolution that will compel, not request, but compel member states to take actions to restrict the travel of their nationals to and from regions controlled by jihadists. A number of critics of the president suspect that Obama and America's European and Gulf allies are planning to use the ISIL challenge as a cover to attack Syrian government forces and proceed with their long-stated goal of removing Syrian President al-Assad from power. Obama, as other critics have pointed out, will be asking the UN's highest body to approve a resolution that he has hesitated to bring to the U.S. Congress. We're going to be speaking about the implications of all this in 20 minutes past the hour when I talk again with veteran retired CIA analyst Ray McGovern, so stay tuned for that. So to bring you up to date on the subject, last Wednesday, by a 273-156 margin, the House voted to grant President Obama authority to train and arm, we are told, moderate Syrian rebels, quote, namely vetted members of the Free Syrian Army who have been up to now fighting against the Assad government, to switch directions and wage war against Islamic extremists. The yes vote was made up of 159 Republicans and 114 Democrats, while 85 Democrats joined 71 Republicans voting no, albeit for different reasons. Presented as an amendment to legislation to keep funding the government, the opposition resulted in a coalition of unusual bedfellows. For example, the East Bay's Barbara Lee and Republican Michelle Bachmann from Minnesota, who rarely vote together on any major issue. Among the no voters was 2nd District's Jared Huffman. Today's vote, quote, was not, as some have argued, a choice between supporting the president's plan and simply doing nothing about ISIL, read a press release from Huffman's website. To be clear, I go on, I share President Obama's assessment of ISIL as a brutal terrorist organization. I support the goal of destroying them, and I believe there should be an American role in a broad multinational response to ISIL. My no vote today, read Huffman's statement, is because this plan for a new American-led war in Iraq and Syria is being advanced without proper congressional authorization, as required by the Constitution, and because I believe the strategic assumptions underlying the plan are deeply flawed. Frankly, we should know better than to provide arms and training to fighters we know very little about, and what we do know is troubling, said Huffman. And we should know better than to do all this on the basis of wishful assumptions and rosy assurances that the conflict will not escalate out of control, end quote. Jared Huffman. Wishful assumptions indeed. The first was that the U.S. occupation forces could train a professional army in Iraq to replace the one it disbanded in 2004. A considerable amount of the taxpayers' money, an estimated $8 billion, was spent on doing that with the results we saw in Mosul. There, the U.S. trained Iraqis fled before ISIL's advance, leaving behind the tanks and artillery weapons supplied by U.S. taxpayers that ISIL has since been using with great effect. Moreover, it is hardly a secret that the U.S. military has been covertly providing military training to Syrian rebels in Jordan, many of them now assumed to be in the ranks of ISIL, for the past several years. This has been happening without congressional assent, and the notion that the process now has the approval of Congress will change anything is the equivalent of putting lipstick on a pig, which, come to think of it, is the best description of the entire gamut of U.S. Middle East operations and policy since invading Iraq and overthrowing Saddam in 2003. Writing in Monday's Independent out of London, veteran British journalist Robert Fisk, who is singularly derisive, particularly about Secretary of State Kerry's efforts to sell Obama's plan to Congress. Said Fisk, most immediately shocking was the Obama fantasy world which Kerry, in his clod-hopping schoolboy way, represented. Anyone who has studied Syria from afar, writes Fisk, let alone those who go there, know that the fictional moderate opposition, supposedly deserters from the Syrian government army, does not exist. Corrupted, disillusioned, murdered, or simply redefected towards ISIS or some other al-Qaeda outfit, the old Syrian army is now a myth as ridiculous and as potent for the Kerrys of the world as Mussolini's boast that the Italian army could defeat the British in North Africa. Any Syrian soldier will tell you, Fisk goes on, that they are happy to fight the FSA because these warriors of the quote-unquote moderate opposition always run away. It's al-Qaeda, Nusra, ISIS terrorists who fight to the death, end quote. All of which makes General Dempsey's, that's Robert Fisk, all of which makes General Dempsey's warning that he may recommend to Obama that he employ U.S. ground forces against ISIL, and Obama's current silence on the subject is something Americans need to be worried about. Adding to that, last week the Washington Post reported that General Lloyd Austin, the general in charge of the military command that includes Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan, recommended that a small contingent of special operations forces be sent to fight alongside Iraqi and Kurdish security forces. While Obama rejected that advice, he traveled to MacDill Air Force Base in Florida, headquarters of U.S. Central Command, last Wednesday to meet with Austin. There he repeated his pledge that a U.S. combat mission was not in the cards, but insisted the Islamic State would be defeated. Well, one alternative is to having U.S. boots on the ground appears to already be underway. According to Stars and Stripes, the U.S. Army Contracting Command posted a notice last month seeking contractors willing to work on an initial 12-month contract who should be, quote, cognizant of the goals of reducing tensions between Arabs and Kurds and Sunnis and Shias, end quote. They would, said the notice, focus on administration, force development, procurement and acquisition, contracting, training management, public affairs, logistics, personnel management, professional development, communications, planning and operations, infrastructure management, intelligence and executive development. The key words there appear to be planning and operations. Obama frequently speaks of the broad-based nature of the coalition the U.S. has put together to defeat ISIL, acknowledging first, among others, Saudi Arabia for agreeing to host a U.S. mission for training moderate Syrian rebels, and with whom Obama said yesterday, quote, "We stand proudly shoulder to shoulder," unquote. This is the same Saudi Arabia which, according to multiple reliable sources, provided the major funding and arms for the jihadists opposed to Syria's Assad. And in the space of 2 weeks last month, according to Amnesty International, executed 22 people, at least 8 of whom were beheaded, according to UN observers. The majority of those executed were charged with non-lethal crimes, including drug trafficking, adultery, apostasy, and sorcery. 4 members of one family, Amnesty reports, were beheaded for, quote, "receiving drugs," end quote. The only apparent difference between the Saudis and ISIL is the latter wants the world to know it, what it's doing, while the Saudis can count on their friends in the White House to look the other way, as they have been doing for years. Well, Washington's best friend in the region, of course, is Israel, which contributed to the carnage by shooting down a Syrian plane with the U.S. supplied Patriot missile yesterday as it flew close to the Israel-Syrian border. The fact that after bailing out, the parachutes of both pilot and single passenger landed in Syrian territory makes it likely that the plane was not over the Israeli-occupied Syrian Golan Heights when it was hit. Israel's Defense Minister Moshe Yaalon, nevertheless, claimed that the Syrian warplane had, quote, "approached Israeli territory in the Golan Heights in a threatening manner and even crossed the border," end quote. Israel said, has, quote, "made it clear in the past and is reiterating now, we will not allow anyone, neither state nor terror organization, to threaten our security and to violate our sovereignty," end quote, said Yaalon, according to the Jerusalem Post. Israeli warplanes routinely violate Lebanese airspace and have done so for years despite complaints from the Lebanese government and the United Nations. Significantly, the United States has not provided Lebanon as well with Patriot missiles. The U.S., as listeners are well aware, is extremely generous when it comes to Israel, but interestingly enough, news of the largesse rarely reaches the American public, as is the case with the following story. The English-language Times of Israel reported last Friday that with over 3/4 of its members as co-sponsors, the U.S. Senate unanimously adopted the United States-Israel Strategic Partnership Act late on the previous evening. The Congress House had already done that earlier. It was as if Israel's bloody assault on Gaza that took over 2,100 Palestinian lives, most of them civilians, and left the country physically and economically devastated had never taken place. The bill declares Israel to be, quote, "a major strategic partner," end quote, of the United States, and its proponents say it will lay the foundations for expanded U.S.-Israel cooperation in defense, energy, agriculture, and a number of other key sectors. The bipartisan resolution was authored by California Democrat Barbara Boxer and Missouri Republican Roy Blunt and had 81 co-sponsors. In addition to declaring that Israel is a major strategic partner of the U.S., legislation increases the frequency and detail of U.S. government reporting on Israel's qualitative military edge. That means that the U.S. assures Israel that its military might, paid for by American taxpayers, will always be greater than that of all the armies in the region combined. It also provides a provision that will expand the authority for forward deployed U.S. weapons stockpiles in Israel. Under the new legislation, the U.S. can increase by $200 million the value of U.S. weapons held in Israel, bringing their total value to $1.8 billion. These stockpiles in Israel have doubled in their value in the past 2 years and are ostensibly meant to speed up U.S. resupply in the event of a crisis in the Middle East, although to my knowledge they never have. In truth, that's just a fig leaf. The weapons in the stockpile are intended for use by Israel in what it considers to be an emergency, such as the slaughter of Gazans. Israel is supposed to reimburse the U.S. for any weapons it used, but since all the weaponry furnished Israel by the U.S. is free, it's questionable if Israel has ever done that. This stockpile, known as the War Reserve Stock Allies, Israel, WRSA-1. I don't know if there's a dash two. Made the news in Israel this summer after the U.S. let Israel gunners use 40-millimeter grenades and 120-millimeter mortar rounds located therein to fire on Gaza. But President Obama held back on releasing additional Hellfire missiles that are fired by U.S.-paid-for Apache helicopters. The legislation will also upgrade Israel's trade status to expedite export licensing, authorize the president to provide assistance to promote cooperation in water, homeland security, agriculture, and alternative fuel technologies. It also included a carefully worded provision to encourage the inclusion of Israel in the visa waiver program. Allowing Israelis to enter the U.S. without securing a tourist visa at U.S. consulate has been a recurring issue for years between Israel and the State Department, but Israel is still not included among the three dozen states with visa-free entry to the U.S. due to complaints from U.S. intelligence agencies that too many Israelis come here to spy. Speaking of spying, according to NSA historian James Banford, writing in the September 16th New York Times, Israel employs total access to all communications between Palestinians and Arab Americans in the U.S. with their family and friends back in Palestine, Lebanon, and elsewhere in the region. That's what he learned while hanging out for a few days with Edward Snowden in Moscow this summer, that, quote, the NSA was routinely passing along the private communications of Americans to a large and very secretive Israeli military organization known as Unit 8200. This transfer of intercepts, Snowden told Bamford, included the contents of the communications as well as metadata such as who was calling whom. Typically, writes Bamford, when such sensitive information is transferred to another country, it would first be, quote-unquote, minimized, meaning the names and other personally identifiable information would be removed. But when sharing with Israel, the NSA did not ensure that the data was modified in this way. Snowden stressed, Bamford wrote, that the transfer of intercepts to Israel contained the communications, emails as well as phone calls of countless Arab and Palestinian Americans whose relatives in Israel and the Palestinian territories could become targets based on communications. It appears, notes Bamford, that Snowden's fears were warranted. The previous week, 43 veterans of Unit 8200, many still serving in the Israeli reserves, accused the organization of startling abuses. In a letter to their commanders, to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and to the head of the Israeli army, they charged that Israel used information collected against innocent Palestinians, quote, for political persecution, end quote. In testimonies and interviews given to the media, they specified that data were gathered on Palestinian sexual orientations, infidelities, money problems, family medical conditions, and other private matters that could be and has been used to coerce Palestinians into becoming collaborators or creating divisions in their society. The veterans of Unit 8200 declared that they had a moral duty to no longer take part in the state's actions against Palestinians, end quote. The memorandum of agreement between the NSA and its Israeli counterpart covers virtually all forms of communication, and while it states that Israel should make use of the intercepts in accordance with U.S. law, it notes that the agreement is legally unenforceable.